Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we are joined by investigative journalist Michael Schneider, and he's going to share with us his research and outlook for the world economy, and particularly the United States. He's been working as an attorney in the heart of Washington, D.C. before he started doing his research and also writing for his popular blog, The Economic Collapse. He's going to share with us kind of a gloomy outlook. He believes the economy is collapsing. But what's really important is to listen to the fundamentals that he's talking about and to understand why he thinks what he thinks. There's a lot of risk factors out there, and he really believes these risk factors that are out there are going to cause the collapse. Whether they happen or not is the question. But they are out there, and they're pretty important. So right now, let's welcome Michael Schneider to the show.
Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Sarah. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. You write a blog called The Economic Collapse, where you're discussing the coming collapse of the U.S. economy. And you've been writing this blog for a while. Why do you think the economy has not collapsed yet?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, a lot of people who write about these things, they kind of hype up the economic collapse as it's this kind of this single big event, kind of like a big Hollywood blockbuster, which is going to come and everyone's going to get all excited about it and it's going to happen and it's going to be horrible and then it's going to be over and then we're going to rebuild. Well, I don't quite see it that way. I see it as something that's happened and that has happened and is happening right now, will continue to happen, a series of waves. So without a doubt, we're not, for example, the financial crisis of 2008 came and really damaged our financial system, our economy, and we've never gotten back, our economy has never gotten back to the same level that it was at previously, you know, in so many different ways. For example, if you just look at the rate of home ownership. During the last recession, it started to fall. But ever since then, it's continued to fall, and now it's fallen for 7 years in a row.
So it hasn't it hasn't balanced out and leveled off. It still keeps falling?
Yeah. The rate of home ownership in this country, which is traditionally an indicator of the health of the middle class, because if you have a healthy middle class, they've got good jobs, they can buy homes for their families, live the American dream, the whole thing. But it hasn't leveled off at all. In fact, it's kept declining. It just had a fresh low, the most recent number that came out. And so now the lowest has been in over 20 years.
Well, do you think we had an artificial increase because we were giving loans to people who really didn't qualify? And so it was artificially high compared to what it normally would be in our society?
Oh, sure. I think that, you know, there was so much about the last housing bubble, which was so artificial. But now in many parts of the country, especially areas like San Francisco or whatever, we're in another tremendous housing bubble, you know, but that's not the only indicator which says, hey, we're in trouble here. We're not as good as we were before. For example, if you look at something called the employment to population ratio, because, you know, if you look at the official unemployment rate, that is so
low,
doctored and politicized. And,
yes,
you know, I don't think it's even really, you know, that helpful anymore. But what I like to prefer to look at is the employment to population ratio. In other words, it's the percentage of working age Americans that actually have a job. And if you go back to the beginning of this millennium, back in the year 2000, we came into this millennium at about 64.5%. Then it started to kind of decline over time. And just prior to the last recession, it was sitting at about 63%. And then during the last recession, it declined precipitously from 63% to below 59%. And it stayed between 58 and 59% from the end of 2010 all the way up until just recently. Now, just in the past few months, it barely peaked back above 59%. But when you compare that to where we were before the last crisis happened, 63%, we're way, way below. If you look at the chart, it's a striking difference. Now, we've had this tiny little uptick, and they're calling that an employment recovery. That's not an employment recovery. That's just a small little bump, upward, which is good that we've at least leveled out. But in no way are we even close to where we were before.
Where were we, like, during the 90s, where were we, percentage-wise?
Well, during the 90s, it was tending to go up over time, and it kind of peaked around the year 2000 at around 64.5%. So, right before the dot-com bubble burst and all that. So, before we had seen this, and for decades it had been slowly going up as women entered the workforce, as the economy was booming. Of course, so much of that was debt-fueled, but in general we had seen an increase over time. But now we've seen a decrease over time, and then, of course, during the last recession it fell dramatically. But it's not just the level of employment, but it's also the quality of the employment in this country, which is just extremely troubling at this point.
Our pay has gone way down compared to what the value of money is now, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because inflation just continues to go up, and the cost of living just continues to go up. Meanwhile, our paychecks are stagnating or decreasing. And so right now, at this point, only 44% of all U.S. adults are employed for 30 or more hours each week. We're becoming a part-time nation. We're becoming a low-wage nation. And like I said, right now, only 44% of all adults are employed for at least 30 hours. That doesn't even mean 40 hours. That means just 30 hours.
But how much do you think of that is because of the Obamacare, where companies – or if you have more than 30 employees, then you're forced to give them benefits.
Well, yeah, that's, and it's not just that law, but the whole way the federal government is set up and all these laws that have been passed, they set up two classes of workers. You got your full-time workers, you got your part-time workers. And full-time workers, they have, by law, more rights and benefits and so on than part-time workers. So there's this incentive that's set up, especially for lower wage industries, to move as many workers from full time to part time as possible. And so, in terms of job growth, we actually have less full time jobs in America today than we did in 2007, even though the population's been growing substantially.
Yeah, how much have we grown? Because that's another good point. Is our population has grown, substantially, but so we have more people that want jobs than they did before.
Yeah, since that time, if I remember correctly, the population's grown by about 28 million since 2007. Meanwhile, like I said, we have less full-time jobs today, and so in terms of income, a lot of families are really struggling. Like back in the old days when I was growing up, a lot of times it was just the father that worked, and he would bring home an income and could support a middle-class family on one income. Today, most families, both parents have to work many times two or three jobs just to try to pay the bills. And so let me give you some numbers that come directly from the Social Security Administration. In America today, 39% of all American workers make less than $20,000 a year. And 52% of all workers, that's more than half of all workers, make less than $30,000 a year. And you can't support a middle-class lifestyle on $30,000 a year.
How do we compare to other countries? I mean, it sounds really low because we're not used to that, but how would we – is it a balancing out of our country and the world? Or have we lost ground compared to other countries? Do you know what I'm saying? Because as we become more of a world economy, we're obviously going to balance out with other countries. But are we losing ground to countries that are more of a first-class, first-world country?
Well, some nations, such as Germany, have been more successful in keeping middle-class jobs, keeping their industry, keeping manufacturing. So, the Germans in particular tend to be doing a little bit better, but what – But meanwhile, like a lot of the rest of Europe is not doing well at all. You know, for example, unemployment rate in Greece is over 25%, and it's also very high in countries like Spain and Italy and so forth. But in general, globally in general, we are seeing a transfer, jobs, good paying jobs moving from wealthy nations where there's expensive workers to nations where there's less expensive workers.
And that's where we're seeing the investments going as well, correct?
Oh, without a doubt. And it's
so it's just the money's moving out of our, you know, the developed nations into the underdeveloped nations where the labor's cheaper and the opportunities are more plentiful.
Yeah, and it's not just jobs and investment, but it's also industry, companies, economic infrastructure. For example, just since 2001, more than 56,000 manufacturing facilities in the United States have permanently shut down, and that number actually is a couple years old, so it's probably actually significantly higher than that by now. But we're seeing our economic infrastructure torn to shreds. You look at a city like Detroit. Once upon a time, actually, most people are shocked when they hear this, the city of Detroit had this highest per capita standard of living in the entire country. In all of the United States, Detroit had the highest per capita income. But today you look at it and it's just a shell of its former self. Unemployment is everywhere. People are suffering. 60% of the children living in the city of Detroit are living in poverty. And most of the industry is long gone.
So I'm assuming you believe that if we would have managed our resources or still manage our resources better, we can maintain a much better lifestyle and still take advantage of opportunities in third world countries. But we're kind of throwing away some of what we have and just abandoning our wealth and our what we have.
Yeah. What we really could use is balanced trade, because we have such tremendously imbalanced trade where, you know, every single month, another $40 or $50 billion, in terms of that's what our monthly trade deficit is, you know, goes out of the country, you know. And so when we, you know, when we go to the store, we fill up our shopping carts from Target or Walmart with stuff made in China or overseas, whatever, you know, we're supporting jobs and businesses over there. Our wealth is leaving and supporting economic infrastructure and all the rest of it over there.
But how do we naturally, I mean, I see the whole country balancing out or the whole world balancing out, because a business is going to naturally purchase a product that costs a fifth the price in a specific country. That, you know, let's say China, the product costs a fifth the price than it does here. A business is just going to do it. So how do politicians and people balance out that trade with that being the backdrop of what's going on?
Yeah, well, part of the problem, what would greatly help is if we didn't have such ridiculously unbalanced trade agreements where we have basically allowed other nations, particularly, for example, China, to just basically abuse us. For example, we allow them to import all of their, you know, most of their products into this country, and without tariffs, without any problems, just, oh, come on in, flood our shores. But then we send stuff over there, and for example, a Jeep, which costs $28,000 in this country, costs the equivalent of over $70,000 in China because
wow.
of the tariffs and everything
yeah.
else. So, you know, part of the blame goes to our politicians, our leaders that have negotiated and come up with these agreements that are just completely unfair, unbalanced, and I mean, to a certain extent,
they're not taking care of our house.
Yeah, they're self-inflicted wounds, because it's not free trade at all. They say free trade, free trade. Well, it's not free trade at all. These trade agreements are totally unbalanced and tilted against the United States, and we are greatly suffering as a result of that.
Well, what it's doing is it's encouraging investment in those areas. So if the big investors are investing in those areas, it's pro them. I mean, it's encouraging it's helping their investments.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does. And in fact, if we had just balanced trade, if the amount that we bought, if the amount that we sold to the rest of the world was the same amount that they bought from us. Our economic growth after inflation cumulatively since mid 2009 would be 19% higher.
Oh, we would really do good, wouldn't we? It would really help our economy.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, our economy would be about 19% larger today, just since mid 2009, if only we just had balanced trade. So,
and I would think China would. They can't. We buy so much from China that we're in a power position that way. I know we owe China a lot of debt, but we also buy so much from them. Why would we not be able to negotiate a fair trade agreement?
Yeah, we should, but the Chinese have been more than happy to take advantage of us. And then what happens is because our money is not going to U.S. Businesses, U.S. workers, then, we're collecting less income, less taxes. So we're not able to fund our government activities fully. So what do we have to do? We have to go over and beg China, oh, please lend our money back to us.
Which we wouldn't even be doing or needing to do to that degree if we would just have a fair, balanced trade agreement in the first place.
Exactly. Once upon a time, a number of decades ago, the Chinese economy was nothing. If we had never, done this in the first place and gone over and started buying all this stuff from China and allowing all of our industry to be shipped over there, China would have never became what they are today. They would never have, we'd never owed them over $1 trillion. They'd never be, our wealth has been transferred over there because we allowed it to happen.
The Congress allowed it to happen. Our government allowed it to happen. And we did it to help specific investors.
Yeah, yeah. And that's part of the problem in this country today is just the greed and the absence of long-term thinking and thinking of what's good for this country.
For the house. For our people.
Yeah. Once upon a time, more businesses were owned by families, but, a lot of business owners, they almost considered their long-term workers, people who've been with them a long time, almost part of the family. But today, these big corporations, they have no loyalty to anyone. If they get bought out or something happens, they'll get rid of someone who's been with them 20, 30 years at the drop of a hat the moment that their usefulness is over, So it's, we need to...
It's a corroding, it's a corroding of society. A lot of people say that culture is the absolute most important thing in a business in order for a business to succeed. The show that I have right now, Gary Miller says culture will eat strategy for lunch. And I mean, that's true with culture in our country. It's true for culture everywhere. I mean, we have to be thinking right in order to be successful. And if we're thinking about just throwing away things that are important and not paying attention to what's valuable, then we're throwing away our future.
Oh, absolutely. And now Barack Obama is negotiating a new global economic treaty. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's doing this in secret. So it's being kept super secret so no one can know what's in this treaty.
That about? I mean, I think anytime you do anything very secretive like that, people start to question. People don't trust you. So what's the deal with that?
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, what's happened is that the only people that are allowed to see it at this point are members of Congress. And what they have to do, they have to go to a basement room where they're handed pages of it one at a time, where they can read it, and then they have to hand it back before they go, and they're banned from actually talking to the public about this. Very, very strange.
But how can they ban them? How does that work? How do they get the power to ban a congressman from talking about legislation?
I don't know actually how that works. It seems like in a republic or a democracy, we're supposed to have public debate about these things. That it kind of goes against everything that we're supposed to stand for, because this treaty is going to affect every man, woman, and child.
I don't know how they get that power. I know. I just don't understand where that power comes from.
I don't know where it is either, but apparently Barack Obama and the Obama administration feel like they have it. And so what they want Congress to do is give them what's called this fast track authority, in which Congress is basically going to entrust Barack Obama with the power to negotiate in secret the final stages of this treaty, and then it will come to Congress, but they can't amend it, they can't change it in any way, they can either vote up or down on it on the final product. So essentially...
Oh, so they'll have a lot of different bills in there that they really want, so... Am I correct, or is it when it goes to fast track, is it just going to be that bill? Or are they going to be throwing in a whole bunch of other crap that they want in order to entice them to vote for this?
No, it'll just be this. It'll just
okay.
be this treaty.
Okay.
But with the fast track, Congress can't amend it, can't change it in any way. But they're basically saying, okay, Barack Obama, we blindly trust you to negotiate this incredibly important treaty for us. And you know, it was the Democrats who were actually objecting to this. The Republicans are the ones in favor of giving Barack Obama this authority, which is so incredibly bizarre to me. I can't even describe how.
So Obama's lined up with the Republicans and the Democrats are fighting him. It's just really is bizarre. And I don't think it should be legal. And they shouldn't, if they vote on it and they vote, so basically, if they vote yes, there's a treaty that the American public has no idea what's in.
Yeah, exactly. And this treaty is going to cover 40% of the entire global economy. And then it's eventually hoped that China and India and the EU will join as well to make it a truly global deal. But to start out with, it's going to cover nations covering 40% of the global economy. And it's not just going to be about economics. Of course, it's going to mean, like we've been talking about, losing more manufacturing, more business, you know, more good jobs out of this country. But it's not just that. According to, there's been leaks throughout the process from different sources around the world about this treaty. And reportedly, some of the topics that are also going to be covered in this treaty include internet freedom. We remember SOPA from a few years ago that got defeated, but apparently so much of what was supposed to be in SOPA is coming into this treaty as well.
So will there be? So we're thinking that they're going to restrict internet freedom in this.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, I've talked to somebody about this before, that censorship of the internet, and this is part of a book that I'm writing of how when the printing press came about, the countries that censored the print, because there was a lot of countries fearful of people disseminating information with the printing press, right? Because it was an explosion of information. And the countries that censored people in the printing press fell behind the countries that didn't, and they still suffer today. And so the countries that are going to start censoring the internet, it's going to have that same phenomena. It's just not good.
Oh, I totally agree. And so that is reportedly going to be in there. Also, it's being reported from some of these leaks that there's going to be provisions regarding health care, regarding copyright and patent protection, regarding food safety, regarding environmental standards, regarding civil liberties. So basically, you know, reportedly, like the economic part of this treaty is only a couple chapters. Most of it is these other things. So basically, the Republicans are saying, okay, Obama, go negotiate all this stuff in secret, which Obama can put all this stuff in there that he could never get through Congress otherwise. And then it's going to come in front of Congress, and Congress is going to say, oh, free trade deal, we're going to approve this. And then there's going to be just, you know, tons and tons and tons of stuff in there that Barack Obama always wanted to do, and that he's going to kind of sneak in this treaty, and then boom.
That's
the
problem. And that's what I was, you know, if, you know, the best form of government is an enlightened dictator, you know, a really enlightened dictator, because everything else is a mess, but that doesn't exist. It just doesn't.
Right.
And so that's why we have this republic that we have, which is like the best of the worst systems, supposedly. And the way that they're doing it now, you know, it's the same thing. If we had somebody who was really good in there and they were all well-meaning and there was a way to change things that they made mistakes on and things, it'd be like, okay, go ahead. But that's not the point. We know through history that that's not how government works, and that you can't trust people in those positions not to have different agendas. And I know that's an awful message for people to hear, but history shows that over and over again. That's why we have a republic, is to be able to debate these things so that the checks and balances work out. And whether I agree with you or you agree with me, it's not the point. The point is to get it out there so that people know what we're doing, because the struggle to get that, to get something done, is better than having people with alternative agendas pushing something through.
Oh, it's very true. It's very true. And so this treaty is a real, real bad deal. But like I said, it's the Republicans, which are really wanting to help Barack Obama with this whole deal, which just is, just blows my mind. So yeah, it's not good. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't see a lot of, hope on the horizon for average American workers, because it's not just jobs leaving high-wage countries going to low-wage countries. But now, for example, you look over in China. China is replacing low-wage workers at some factories with robots.
Oh, I'm sure, yes.
Yeah, some of the, like Foxconn, one of the, you know.
Well, that'll just continue, and people have to evolve and go towards. And I did a show on that where I think there's been something like 20 million jobs that have already migrated because of technology. And that's just going to keep coming, right? And so the whole point is for us to educate people into different types of work, the different workforce. We have to rethink it.
Oh, it's true. But, you know, what futurists ponder is, what do we get down the road when the robots and the computers and can do everything better than us, more cheaply than us? You know, where does that leave human workers? It's, it's going to change things, because, you know, what that does is the number of jobs for the rest of us continues to shrink down because they're being shipped overseas or being replaced by technology. It causes an increase in competition for the jobs that remain. For example, when I was a youngster, one day I went over to my local McDonald's. I said, I'd like a job. They hired me on the spot because they were desperate for workers, for anyone, you know, 16-year-old kids.
Yes, exactly.
Whatever. But these days now, the average age of a minimum wage worker in the United States is 36. You know, there's great competition even for any job at this point. Even a minimum wage job.
So I think what you are doing such a great job documenting on your blog is the equalization of the global economy and the implementation of technology everywhere and how that's affecting the United States, and also the fact that our Congress is supporting investment out of this country and the bills and things. So it's a three-pronged problem. It's the technology, it's the natural evolution of technology and the globalization. But on top of that, it's much worse because of two other issues. So it's maybe a four-pronged problem. The fact that our Congress is, that these bills are supporting investors into third world countries because there's more opportunities there. So we're helping them get better investments, which is ridiculous. As long as if it was equal and just natural investments and what they would naturally make, that's fine. But to help them make more than what they should, that's ridiculous. And then the fourth problem is our debt and how we're managing money, which we haven't even gotten into yet.
Yeah, we're, you know, and as our underlying economy kind of crumbles, as you know, we inherited the greatest economic machine in the history of the world, and in my opinion, we've essentially wrecked it. But to prop up our standard of living, what have we done? We've indulged in the greatest debt binge in the history of the planet, and it's gotten so much worse here in recent years. For example, you go back to 2007, just before the last recession, our national debt was sitting at about $9 trillion. Today, it's crossed the $18 trillion mark. So if you look back right before the last financial crisis, you know, we're in far worse condition today. And of course, it's not just government debt. If you look at overall debt, the total ball of wax, I'm talking about all government debt, all forms of business and corporate debt, all forms of individual and consumer debt, the whole ball of wax, about 40 years ago, it was about $2.5 trillion. Today, it's over $58 trillion.
That's crazy.
So it is. So to prop up our standard of living, to live the way that we feel about, like we should live as Americans, we've had to do it with debt. And all this prosperity we've been enjoying has been fueled by debt, which eventually all debt bubbles eventually collapse. But, you know, if anyone that's ever lived on debt or credit cards, you know, you can go out, you can get a huge mortgage, you can get a couple of fancy cars on debt, you can run up your credit cards to the ceiling, but eventually a day of reckoning is coming, and a day of reckoning is definitely coming for this country as well.
Well, the sad part is if we would manage our finances like you would your own, a responsible person would do with a business or their own house or your own family, you would have fair trade agreements, and then you'd also manage your debt. And then it would allow you to deal with the natural issues, which, and try to take advantage of them, which is the globalization and technology. Because there's a lot of opportunities in technology and globalization. So if we would have managed our things that we can control in a responsible way, then we can take advantage of the things that we can't control and try to use it as to our benefit instead of what we're doing now. And not to the benefit of a few, but to the benefit of the whole. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's the difference between short-term thinking and long-term thinking, you know? What we're doing to future generations of Americans, if Thomas Jefferson once warned us, he said, you know, don't government debt is essentially stealing money from future generations. But we didn't listen to him. And now we've loaded $18 trillion of debt on the backs of future generations. Someday they'll look back on us, and if they get the chance, they'll curse us for what we've done to them, for this horrible burden that we've put onto them, the largest mountain of government debt in the history of the world, which is what we're giving to them as their inheritance. It's not right.
Well, the frustrating part is there's a lot of good people that understand that this isn't how you manage anything. And the problem is we're not doing anything about it. It's very obvious to anyone who knows how to manage a large company or knows how to even manage their own finances. When you start thinking about it, it's just so obvious, some of these things that you need to do, and we're just not doing it. And it's really kind of you kind of shake your head. Why aren't we doing some of these basic things? It's just so strange.
Yeah, and once again, a lot of it comes back to the leadership in Washington, D.C., you know, which they keep making the same mistakes over and over again, but the American people keep sending them back. In fact, for the 2014 midterm election, incumbents won re-election at about a 95% rate. And at this point, in Congress, there are 79 members of Congress that have been in office for at least 20 years. So you get these people in there, they stay forever, they never change, and they keep doing the same things over and over again. It's just insanity.
Well, you know, other economists believe, there's a small number of them, I would assume they believe the same thing as you when they say it's a slow burn. You know, Catherine Austin Fitz is one that says that we're in a slow burn. She doesn't think there's going to be an economic collapse. But your economic collapse definition really is like hers. It's just a slow burn. A slow thing going downward.
Although, well, that's what we've seen over the past several decades, because I believe this is decades in the making. However, you know, we have started to see these waves. For example, the dot-com bubble burst. Then 2007, 2008, that was the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression, and that was even worse than the wave that came before. But I believe we're approaching another major wave, and I do believe that events are about to start accelerating greatly. In fact, I believe that they're going to start accelerating by the end of this calendar year. I've never said that before. But let me explain to you why.
Okay.
Because, you know, we've talked about government debt and all that. But one of the greatest threats that we're facing is our financial system. And at the heart of this, our financial system are these giant too-big-to-fail banks. And after the last crisis, we were told, oh, we're going to do something about too-big-to-fail. We're going to fix this problem, right? We all heard that we're never going to let this happen again. Well, unfortunately, that hasn't happened. In fact, the too-big-to-fail banks have gotten approximately 40% larger since the last financial crisis. Meanwhile, 1,400 smaller banks have gone out of existence, have disappeared from the system. So the problem of too-big-to-fail is bigger than ever before.
It's an unhealthy balance in any economy is when you have too much power and too few hands. A free market system doesn't work well.
Yeah, and the thing is these too-big-to-fail banks, they account for approximately 42% of all loans, and they control approximately 67% of all assets in our financial system. And everything in our system depends on the flow of debt and credit. You want to buy a house, you got to get a mortgage. You want vehicles, you got to get car loans. If you want to go to school, you know, if you want, you know, we pay for everything with our credit cards. So without the flow of debt and credit, we essentially don't have an economy. That's why the health of these institutions is so absolutely critical. Unfortunately, they have become far more reckless than ever before.
Well, with their derivatives, correct?
Exactly. That
can you explain what a derivative is?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes when I use that term, people tune out because they say, oh, that sounds complicated. That
exactly.
Sounds kind of convoluted. And they are. They can be extremely complicated.
But only because it doesn't have to be complicated, right?
No, it doesn't have to be. But, you know, they're so complicated that sometimes people in the financial industry, you know, really don't even truly understand them. But I like to really simplify things. And on a very simple level, derivatives are essentially, some people compare them to insurance contracts. I like to compare them to wagers or side bets. Like if I went to Las Vegas and I bet that the Chicago Cubs would win the World Series this year, it's either going to happen or it's not. I'm either going to win money or I'm going to lose money.
Well, I want to say one thing before you keep explaining this. It's important for people not to tune out when it comes to derivatives. And so if you're starting to tune out now, please don't tune out, because I just heard a stat that 95%, those six banks that you're talking about, have control of 95% of all the derivative markets, and it's unregulated and it's really dangerous. And so people really do need to understand what derivatives are, because it's the largest part of our economy. But anyways, please keep going.
Yeah. It's different from a normal investment. Normally, if you buy a stock, you're buying equity in a company. You're buying an ownership interest in a company. If you buy a bond, you're buying the debt of a company or a government. And so you're investing in something that is more real. But derivatives, you're not investing in anything real. You're just you're betting either for, say, interest rates will go up, interest rates will go down. You know, so, and they take a whole bunch of different forms. But it's basically a form of legalized gambling. And these two big-to-fail banks, there's two big-to-fail banks in the United States. Five of them have total exposure to derivatives in excess of $38 trillion. And if that sounds like an enormous amount of money, that's because it is. Keep in mind, the U.S. national debt is just $18 trillion. So when you're talking about this kind of money, you're talking about an amount of money that is almost unimaginable.
What's our current GDP?
Well, I'll go through these different banks and give you the numbers. For example,
okay.
Morgan Stanley, they have total assets of $801 billion. That's B with a little B. $801 billion. That's less than $1 trillion. But they've got total exposure to derivatives of more than $38 trillion. Bank of America, they've got total assets of $2.1 trillion. Total exposure to derivatives, more than $54 trillion. Goldman Sachs, total assets, less than $1 trillion. Total exposure to derivatives, more than $57 trillion. Citibank, total assets, about $1.8 trillion. Total exposure to derivatives, more than $59 trillion. And then the biggest bank in America, J.P. Morgan Chase, total assets of about $2.6 trillion, total exposure to derivatives, more than $63 trillion. So if these bets, and most of the times they use, you know, very sophisticated computer algorithms, you know, which help them most of the time to come out on the winning side of these bets. But if these bets start going against these big financial institutions, they could be wiped out very, very rapidly.
Well, and that's what happened in 2008, correct? I mean, there was the mortgage meltdown, but it was behind the scenes was the derivatives behind that, which caused the big meltdown.
And that was the whole thing with AIG, you know. AIG,
and Goldman Sachs, yes.
Yeah, the AIG didn't get in trouble because they wrote a bunch of bad life insurance policies. They got in trouble with derivatives. That's why the largest insurance company in the country had to be bailed out, because it was of these derivatives.
But they bailed out AIG. The government didn't. All that money went back to the banks that had the derivatives.
Yeah,
right?
It was,
the derivative contracts.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs was one of them. So Goldman Sachs greatly benefited by that bailout, definitely, without a doubt. But, you know, I believe that what happened in 2008 was just a preview of what's coming. I mean, when you're talking about tens of trillions of dollars at each of these banks, you know, when this bubble bursts.
Well, what could trigger this? What could trigger it? Because last time what triggered it was the mortgage meltdown. What would trigger it this time? Could Greece, for example, if Europe fell, could Greece trigger that?
It could. It could. There's a number of things that could potentially trigger this. One of these is actually the energy industry. We've seen the price of oil. Just before the last financial crisis in 2008, the price of oil shot up dramatically to well over $100 a barrel. Then it crashed down to $40 a barrel. That caused all kinds of problems. The only other time in all of the history we've seen anything like that is just recently. Last year, the price of oil went up above $100 a barrel for a time. Now it's crashed down to about half that level. It's been, you know, going up and down a little bit here in recent weeks. But, there are trillions of dollars of these derivatives tied to the energy industry and the health of these fracking companies, these shale oil companies and so on. And so, you know, and a lot of these big banks are involved in that. So that's one thing. Then also currency rates. There are tens of trillions of dollars of derivatives tied to the value of the U.S. dollar, the euro, the Japanese yen, and the exchange rates and so forth. And so, in recent months, we've started to see the dollar really strengthen. We've seen the euro start to tumble. We've started to see currencies move dramatically. So there are tens of trillions of dollars of these derivatives tied to that. But then the biggest one is interest rates. That's where Greece kind of comes in, because around the world, according to the Bank for International Settlements, globally, talking the entire planet, there are $441 trillion of derivatives tied to interest rates, which is the biggest category of all.
Sure.
And so, for example, if Greece collapses and their bond yields start soaring through the roof and their interest rates start going crazy with Greece, of course, that'll affect the rest of Europe, Spain, Italy, Portugal, and the rest of the European countries as well. Their bond yields will start spiking. Their interest rates will start going crazy. And we've even seen the 30-year yield in the U.S. here start to rise pretty dramatically in recent days. You know, there are so many of these derivatives tied to interest rates. If we start seeing dramatic, huge moves in interest rates in the Western world, that could alone set off a massive derivatives crisis involving hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives. So, I mean, this is really a sword of Damocles that is hanging over the global economy that could strike at any time. And so I believe the next great financial crisis is going to involve these derivatives. I believe it's going to be the greatest financial crisis the world has ever seen. It's going to be worse than the stock market crash of 1929. And it's going to plunge us into a worse time, I believe, ultimately, than the Great Depression of the 1930s. We're going to see unemployment skyrocket. We're going to see a great credit crunch as all of a sudden these banks aren't lending money to anyone, to each other, to anyone else. It's going to seem like nobody has any money to spend. And then, of course, the governments around the world and central banks are going to try to intervene and try to do some things. But it's going to be a time of craziness like we've never seen before. And it's because of this reckless gambling, this incredible foolishness on the part of these financial institutions and ultimately our government leaders.
Well, we almost have to, you know, there's a lot of people that have been warning of the derivatives problems and how risky they really are to our health of our economy. You almost have to see that collapse to clean it up, because we won't clean up things unless something gets really bad. So there almost has to be a complete meltdown in order for us to start over.
Yeah, and I agree with you. You know, there's been so many people warning for so many years, but we just keep doing the same things, making our long-term problems even worse. The bubbles just keep getting bigger. That's why basically I have basically no hope of any type of solution to these things, because they've been warned about for so long. There's no sign of a solution anywhere on the horizon, and I believe we've had warnings for years, and now I believe we're right at the precipice of the next great financial crisis. And so that's why I encourage people to get prepared on an individual, a family, and a community level, because the government's not going to fix things.
Well, you know, I used to think that if Greece would just declare bankruptcy and move on, if they would have done that back in 2008 or close to that, they probably could have done it and been isolated, kind of like Iceland did. But if they do it now, would that have just huge ramifications for everybody?
Oh, it is. It is, because so many banks around Europe are tied into Greek government debt, and actually the Greek banking system's on the verge of total meltdown and total collapse, and the financial system of Europe is so interconnected. And then once Greece collapses, because we are told, oh, we've got a plan, and time after time there's been like, oh, we've got a plan, we've got a solution, but it was really just kicking the can down the road. And so if Greece finally fails after all these efforts, everyone's going to be wondering, okay, who's next? And there are some really good candidates. For example, Italy, which is one of the largest economies in Europe, is heading down the exact same path as Greece. So is Spain. You know, so is Portugal. So is France to a large degree. And so all of a sudden, if they see, oh, Greece failed, who's next? And so then people start pulling their money out of Italian bonds, Spanish bonds, Italian banks, Spanish. I mean, there would be so much.
It'd be a mess. Yeah. So basically, declaring bankruptcy would have been really good back then, like Iceland did, because Iceland's really doing pretty good right now. But, you know, and they were doing awful in 2008, and they declared bankruptcy, went through this hard time that lasted a couple of years, and now they're doing better than almost everybody. Whereas if Greece would have done the same thing, it would have been a good thing for them. But now it would be a nightmare for everybody.
Yeah, and if Greece pulls out of the euro, that's going to be a signal to the rest of the world that the euro is not permanent. And if you're part of it today, you could be out of it tomorrow. And so it changes the whole confidence that the world has in the euro, and which I expect to see some big problems there. And actually, I expect to, you know, when this thing blows up, for the euro to drop to all-time lows. I expect a big tumble in the euro coming up in the not too distant future.
Well,
Greece is actually almost out of money now.
Yeah, that's what I've been reading too. So I always thought that the United States, the only way we're ever going to get out of this problem is to just declare bankruptcy at some point, because we can't. It doesn't look like we'll actually go face to face with our issues and solve anything. But if we declared bankruptcy, then our world power status would be changed. I mean, we have military all over the world. So there's so many ramifications of us doing something like that, that I just don't, that's why I think this slow burn and doing whatever they can to keep the status quo is what they're doing, because nobody knows how to deal with that loss of power.
Oh yeah. And it's not just the loss of power, but loss of standard of living, because, you know, once things collapse, no one's going to want to buy our debt anymore. No one's going to want to even use our currency as the primary reserve currency of the world, which gives us an awesome advantage, because most Americans don't realize this, but outside our country, more dollars are used than inside our country. You know, and this creates a tremendous demand for U.S. dollars, and causes the value of the U.S. dollar to be much higher than it otherwise would be.
But that's why so if we were smart, we would solve some of our problems and just be able to maintain our position, like stop having those trade agreements that are out of balance. Because immediately, if we could get a bump in our GDP, that would be huge, and we could start to balance our budget that way. And if we started dealing with some of our debt issues with the Federal Reserve, we started issuing. You know, there's economists that think if we created a public bank, and so we didn't have to pay all that interest for issuing currency, which is a huge, I mean, that's a whole nother topic for another show, but we could save just an incredible amount of money. And so we have some solutions to keep us in a really good position, but we just won't do it.
Yeah. Our politicians just keep doing the same things they've always been doing.
And but you think it's because they don't understand, or because they don't have the political power to get it done? And they don't have the courage.
I think it's a combination, and sometimes it's just easier to keep doing the same things that you've always been doing. And you know, I think it's a combination of factors. But sometimes change would be hard. Change would be disruptive. And politicians, they don't like to cause pain, because if people are feeling pain, they tend to vote for someone else.
Well, they cause pain, so they get voted out of office, and they can't do anything anyways, because our people don't understand what's going on. So anybody that wants to make positive change just gets voted out of office because nobody understands.
Yeah, yeah, and so
come on,
that's
people.
Why it's easier to keep saying, okay, let's keep spending more money in the short term, keep going in more debt in the short term. Because if you think longer term and you're like, okay, we got to think longer term, we got to make some sacrifices right now for the benefit of our country in the longer term, politicians don't like to do that because then people start getting upset, you know?
Well, mainstream economists are saying everything's fine. I mean, they're, people are investing in the stock market like, back in 1929. I mean, people are exuberant about what's going on right now. And there has been an uptick in the economy lately. So what do you think of that? I mean, why are mainstream economists ignoring and the media ignoring this stuff? Because the principles, when you talk to economists behind the scenes, they all know that the principles, there's a lot of issues here. But the mainstream economists and the media is not talking about it.
Yeah, it's our capacity for self-delusion is absolutely amazing. We saw the bubble, the dot-com bubble, and they at the time they were saying, "Oh yeah, this is sustainable. This can keep going on forever." Of course, that burst. Then 2007, 2008. Oh yeah, it's going to be fine. And at the time, the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, was saying, "Oh, there's not going to be a recession." But of course, it was the worst recession since the Great Depression. Mainstream economists, these talking heads, they never warn us in advance. But we see the same things happening that we saw, for example, before the dot-com bubble burst, margin debt, this giant peak, and then it bust. And 2007, 2008, margin debt. In other words, people were borrowing tons and tons of money to put in the stock market. Spiked dramatically. There was another busting. And now, if you look on a chart of margin debt, people borrowing tons and tons of money to put into the stock market, there's this third giant peak of margin debt in all of U.S. financial modern American history. There's been three giant peaks of margin debt, and we're in this third peak. And people are saying, "Oh, it's different this time. It's different this time." But on my website, theeconomicclassblog.com, I show how not only that pattern, but pattern after pattern after pattern that we saw just before the last financial crisis, just before the one before that, that are happening again, and yet people are still in denial.
Yes, that's true. So, Alan Greenspan is telling people to invest in gold. And he's actually coming out and saying some things. And aren't some of the other wealthy people doing some that as well? You like to dig into what the wealthy are doing because they get the best advice. And so what are they doing right now? Because that gives you a better indication of what's going on.
Yeah, we've seen the smart money move out of just recently longer-term bonds, like 30-year bonds, into real shorter-term bonds that could be liquidated in an emergency. We've seen the smart money start to move out of the stock market, and the people that are coming in and propping it up at this late hour are the retail investors. Basically, the dumb money is rushing in here, right before it bursts. We're seeing also the smart money move into gold and silver. For example, J.P. Morgan Chase has accumulated just the biggest hoard of physical silver in the history of the planet. I wrote about that recently, where they're just going crazy buying physical silver, which up to now, physical silver has gone down a bit. So up until now, it's been a loser for JP Morgan Chase. But if we have a great crisis, in fact, at this point, they have, since early 2012, JP Morgan stockpile has grown from less than 5 million ounces of physical silver to more than 55 million.
Well, I always believe that when there's a fall in gold or silver, it's on purpose. It's not by accident because somebody wants to buy a lot of it. That's just my opinion. Just because we know from the beginning of, for 100 years, we know that that stuff's been manipulated. There's so much facts out there showing that. But, what is Warren Buffett doing with his money? I think that's a good indicator. Do you happen to follow him at all?
I don't know what he's been doing lately. So I don't know that I have that information, but, I would just encourage people to, listen for that word derivatives. When they hear that word, that's going to be a sign if there's a problem with the derivatives or a derivatives crisis talked about in the mainstream news, that's a sign that we're really, really late in the game. And I just encourage people to, even do some basic things like the last crisis, 2008. all of a sudden, millions of people started to lose their jobs because they didn't have anything to fall back on. They couldn't pay the mortgage. They lost their homes. There are all these foreclosures. So I'm encouraging people, build up an emergency fund. If something happens, you lose your job or your business starts hurting, you have something to fall back on. You can keep paying your bills. You know, do some of those common sense things. And anything you can do to become more independent of the system. You know, learning to grow a garden. So, you know, if the fruits and vegetables, you know, they're so expensive, you know, at the stores, whatever. If you grow some of your own, you're more independent of the system. You know, because the system, I believe, is failing and it's going to get progressively worse. So whatever you can do to become independent of the system, I think is a good thing.
Well, where can people see more of your work? Because you have a very interesting, different perspective. I actually read a lot of your work because that's where I get a lot of facts about, you know, just alternative facts on what's going on. And whatever you believe, it's really good to dig into different sources of information so that you can get at facts and information that you can't get elsewhere very easily. And you're one of the people that provide that. Where can people see more of your work?
Yeah, the primary website I'm known for is the Economic Collapse blog. You can find it at theeconomiccollapseblog.com, or if you just go to Google and type in The Economic Collapse, it's the first result that comes up. On that website, I primarily focus on the economy and so many of the things we've been talking about today. I also write for a website called endoftheamericandream.com, and on there I post articles about broader social political issues, about war, about culture, about Congress, about so many other things. And then I have a couple of books which people can find on Amazon.com. One is a novel, The Beginning of the End, in which I call it Faction, in which it's a mystery slash thriller set in the near future in the United States. But I've included so much of the things I write about, but put it in a very entertaining fictional format. And then a new book that was just released, Get Prepared Now, I co-authored with an expert on prepping, in which in this book I talk about why the economy is going to collapse, why we need to get prepared. And then she talks about the hows, the practical how-to steps about how to get prepared for the difficult years that are coming.
Okay, well, that's really great. So once again, it's the economiccollapseblog.com. And I'll have that on my radio page and also on my website as well at sarahwestall.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Sarah. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I happen to think that there are a lot of positive things going on right now with technology and just the burst of information that we're getting and the communication between cultures. I think that this is a wonderful opportunity in our human existence for us to grow and to become a better race of people. But along that journey, I think that there's a lot of stuff that we have to fix. And one of those things are how we deal with money and the economy and how we keep irresponsible management of that from destroying our opportunity. And I think that Michael has some important information to share with people. And if you want to see more, make sure you go to his blog at the economiccollapseblog.com. You can also see his contact information on my website at sarahwestall.com. And for now, you have a wonderful day.